Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome back to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm your host this week, Linda P. Jones of BeWealthyAndSmart.com and the Be Wealthy and Smart Podcast. This week, our guest is John Richardson from ConsistentOptionsIncome.com. We're going to talk about options strategies and options trading, a long-lost art that John specializes in and has some interesting things to say. Here he is. I'm so excited to have on the show today John Richardson. John, how are you doing today?
Great, Linda, and thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about how you got into options trading.
Somewhere around the late 80s, I had some extra income. I was starting to make some decent money. And so I sought the counsel of my father to find out what I should do with it. And he said, you know, put it in mutual funds, which were, at least to me, seemed kind of new back then. So I marched over to the Fidelity office and was kind of underwhelmed with my alternatives. At the time, I was getting conversant with computers. So I said, you know what, I'm gonna have my computer pick, you know, the things I should invest in. So I started an odyssey that lasted about 10 years of writing all these kind of mechanical trading systems. What I learned through that process was that, you know, a lot of mechanical trading systems, I think I developed some good systems, but they all have this one sort of Achilles heel, which is they go through these horrendous, inhumane drawdowns, and they, you know, they're testing your faith all along the way. So it was kind of a miserable way to trade. And so I started looking for some other ways and actually changing my opinion about how I thought the markets work. Like up to that point, I thought it was just some magical formula. I needed to figure out the math, the proper math formula, and all of a sudden I'd have a winning system. And I think that really wasn't true. So I had to kind of change my perspective, which is really difficult, because then I thought, well, how am I going to solve this if it's you know, more organic than mathematical? And so one of the things I got into was options, and the flexibility that options offered me really helped me come up with a much more strategic approach. So that was kind of around the late 90s.
Interesting. So when you say it was more organic, can you tell us more about that?
Sure. I think I thought the market was this mathematical being, because everything you got from the market was numbers, right? Mm-hmm. And so it kind of leads you down that path. But I think the market in total is much more like a person, right? If you start thinking of the market as a person, and then you think, well, how am I going to predict what this person's going to do, you know, today, tomorrow, or a week from today? All of a sudden, the problem becomes a little bit different, and you have to be a little bit more strategic. I think that's difficult at first for people to admit that, right? But once you do, once you start seeing it that way, I think you can be a little bit more successful, because I think you have a better perspective on what your risks are and whatnot.
So you're kind of saying that people think that things move in straight lines and formulas like math, but it's really more like cyclical kind of things and waves of things, because that's how our planet works?
Well, even waves and cycles are mathematical to some degree. So it's much more fluid and organic, like a person would be. You know, if you tried to track my behavior over the course of a week, there are probably some places that I go and whatnot. Of course, if there's some sure things where I go, you know, every Tuesday at 3, the market's not going to reward you for that, right? Because everybody knows that. And so what people are in the business is trying to predict those other times where there's a huge benefit, and there's a reward much outweighs the risk type of situation. And those are much harder to do. And so that's, I think, where options can give you some flexibility and be strategic in approaching those more difficult to predict situations.
Interesting. So you're fond of saying the investment industrial complex has failed the average investor. What do you mean by that?
Sure. I think I say that in kind of tongue in cheek. It's kind of a play on President Eisenhower's warning about the military industrial complex. And I guess his warning was that, hey, you know, there's all these generals in the Pentagon. They like war toys. And then there's this whole industry providing, you know, those toys at inflated prices. And then there's an incentive. There's these kind of perverse incentives built in, you know, to kind of break the toys and then replenish them with better, bigger toys. And so his warning was that that sort of conflict and incentives was, you know, kind of a danger to democracy. And obviously my warning is not quite as dire, but I think that the incentives built in to the investment community, you know, big banks and brokerage firms, kind of underserves the average investor. I kind of harken back to my first experience. I walked into a Fidelity office with what to me was a large sum of money at the time. It was probably only a couple thousand dollars. I was kind of expecting that I would see this sort of, you know, older gentleman, you know, graying sideburns, a nice suit, a Rolex. You know, obviously, if he's been in the investment business, he's had lots of opportunities to get wealthy. And instead, I was greeted by, you know, some kid who was, you know, younger than I was. And I was pretty young at the time. So, and then he gave me a, you know, presentation. It was like in a binder, you know, had some laminated pages. And I fully expected, you know, to have him ask his manager to come and close for him, you know. And it was such a stark difference between what my expectation was and what the reality was that it kind of was a red flag for me. And that's kind of why I went off on my own and said, you know what, I'm going to try to do this on my own. And I think that over time, you know, the big banks and brokerage firms kind of, you know, they just want your money to manage it. And then they tend to underperform, you know, in terms of their mutual fund choices or whatnot. When the markets tank, where that's really where you expect some help, you know, they just kind of go, oh, well, you know, everybody else is in the same boat. What are we going to do? I think it catches people off guard because people like to, you know, outsource their investments because they don't have the time or interest. And it kind of underserves because the incentives aren't really there. I mean, nobody really knows what the future is, and nobody really can predict what your investments are going to do. So it's always best, I think, to have a hands-on. You know, I've talked to so many people who have suffered greatly through some market downturns, and, you know, what happens is people think, well, I'll just close my eyes, and in 20 or 30 years, I'll wake up and I'll have, you know, kind of an average return. And a lot of times the market downturns can happen, you know, at the end of that period, or they've gone through their saving years, and all of a sudden they don't go to cash, you know, which is, what, I guess, part of what the plan is supposed to be, because it's safe, you know, fixed income. But they, you know, the returns right now, and, you know, your savings account are pretty much nothing, so people leave it in stocks and whatnot, and then they get a big downturn, and all of a sudden now they can't satisfy their monthly spending needs, drawing down on their accounts. So, you know, they're back to, you know, being a greeter at Walmart or something. And so it can be pretty sad. So I think I see as part of my purpose is to try and help people overcome what can be a complex subject and learn how to turn their money into income. Because no matter how much you save over your life, at some point you have to generate an income. And just leaving it sitting in the stock market isn't the best way to do that necessarily.
Mm-hmm. So your strategies are more income-oriented than growth-oriented, would you say?
Yes, the particular strategy that I teach, I've been teaching it since 2008. Some people use it kind of as a growth-type strategy, but it's really meant to be an income strategy.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about how that works.
One of the characteristics of the strategy is that we start with something that's adjustable, right? And a lot of times when people are making trades or investments, they kind of do a lot of research, and then they kind of figure out what's going to happen or what they think is going to happen, and then they kind of make a bet based on that outcome. And what happens is, you know, that's hard to do. People find that out pretty quickly. And so what we want to do is we want to start with something that's adjustable right from the beginning. And so we choose a trade structure with options that is adjustable. And then we go into the trade planning to adjust it. So there's lots of, like, if you do like a Google search for adjustment strategies or whatnot, there's probably a lot of stuff out there. But I think they're more properly termed like repair strategies, right? They're strategies like all of a sudden now you're in trouble and you have to do something to fix your trade. Because we go into the trade planning to adjust it, we're more proactive. And so we can kind of change or modify our trade so that we can react to whatever is happening in the market. It's kind of like, I envision it kind of like, you know, a catcher's mitt, you know, and he can kind of move the trade around or move our mitt around to try and capture a modest return more easily. And that's another hallmark of the trade also, is that we start with a fairly larger, compared to other income traders, other options income traders, we start with a fairly large, relatively large potential profit, but we're only looking to capture about 5% of the potential profit. So it's much easier to do. And so the whole, you know, the higher sort of purpose is like do something that's very consistent, right? Because if you're counting on a trading strategy for income, it's going to have to be consistent, right? You don't want to make all your money in month 12, right? It doesn't really help you all the other 11 months.
Huh, it sounds really interesting. Well, a lot of people think that options trading is super risky. So what would you say to them?
Anything can be risky, right? It just depends on how you use it. Your car can be risky. But and the way people use options sometimes can be risky because there's leverage built in. That's kind of where the real risk comes from, because you can end up trading larger than you think you are. So what we do is our trade is always a fixed margin, fixed risk trade. So because the combination of pairing options together, we can fix our risk at a certain amount, yet still leave ourselves open to make some profits. So it really comes down to how you use the options, really. For maybe some of your audience who don't necessarily know much about options, they're really kind of like insurance contracts. That's the way I see them. And most people end up buying insurance most of their life, which in the market is a bad trade, right? Because it usually don't use your insurance. So we're much more in the game of like selling insurance, but doing it in a more fixed risk way. Whereas like in your insurance companies, the way they manage their risk, when they sell you insurance, if they only sold one policy and then your house burned down, that would, you know, they don't have enough money to cover the expense. So what they do is they do lots of policies, right? And that waters down their risk. But what we do is similar to that. We control our risk by not only adjusting our trade, but by you know, buying some options around the stuff we're selling to protect the credit that we receive.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think most investors and traders lose money in financial markets?
Yeah, I think based on my own experience and all the traders I've talked to over the years, I think there's kind of this culture in trading and investing where people are swinging for the fences, right? And I think it's like a casino where you go in and there's that one big machine, and if you put a dollar in, you could potentially win a million, right? It's kind of like the lotto. But if there was a machine right next to it where if you put, for every $10 you put in, you get 11, you know, nobody's going to be interested in that. We're drawn to the big returns. And I think part of it's driven because people are used to losing money in the markets, and so they think they have to win big to make up for all their losses. And so I think that's, people get drawn down that path of swinging for the fences when, in reality, if they have a reasonable approach and they have reasonable expectations, they can just hit base hits over and over, and that's really how they're going to make money.
Mm-hmm. So what's the proper framework to see profits?
I think that the first step is to admit that you don't know what's going to happen in the future. So once you can get past that, all of a sudden your thinking changes, because I think most people go into it placing bets, right? I know it's going to be on the roulette table. I know it's going to be red, you know, and that's kind of how our culture works to a large extent. So once we know that, hey, we don't know what's going to happen, that's, I think, the first step. Then the next step is having modest expectations. We're not going to clean up overnight. We're going to be, you know, kind of the slow turtle who just moves and prods along, and over time we're going to do a lot better than everybody else around us. And I think the key to that is, like I said earlier, is starting with something that's adjustable and then having this mindset that I'm going to adjust it as the market changes, because I don't know what was going to happen. I didn't really make a prediction, so I'm going to have to modify my trade to accommodate whatever the market's doing. And I think the trade that I teach kind of bridges two big camps in the market. One is like this camp that says, hey, the markets are completely efficient and they're completely random. That's probably the better way to view the markets, but there are actually statistically aberrant things that happen all the time. If the market was perfectly random, everything would fall within a nice bell curve. You know, kind of like 2008, everybody thought, well, housing prices never go down. Here's the bell curve for housing prices. But then all of a sudden we had this statistically aberrant move, and it, you know, created this financial crisis. And on the other hand, there's this, you know, school that thinks that, well, the markets are inefficient and they're predictable. And that's not true either. So it's kind of difficult to rationalize that, because you can't really be in one camp or the other. You kind of have to treat it as generally random, but then accommodate those sort of statistically aberrant things that happen all the time. And I think, I don't think I really thought of this trade that way in the beginning, but I think essentially we always have a bias in our trade. So it's kind of like we're trading directionally, but we're using time decay and options to kind of make up for the inefficiencies of that process. And by adjusting our trade, we can take advantage of the time decay and also be on the side of any move that might materialize.
So it doesn't matter to you whether the markets are volatile or not volatile, or do you do better with one or the other kind of market?
Well, actually, I prefer a more volatile environment. As far as our trade goes, when implied volatility is high, we get more money for the options that we're selling. But then the options that we're buying cost more, too. So that's kind of a wash there. But what we end up having in a high implied volatility environment is we have situations where the market can make substantial moves, and that helps us. As long as we're adjusting our trade and we can be on the right side of that move, we can usually get out of our trade more quickly and with better profit.
Mm-hmm. So it's probably been a pretty interesting start of the year for you.
Yes, and one of the things also, people worry, especially people who have tried to trade options for income, one of the things they worry about a lot is big market moves, right? They can really hurt you, especially income traders. Because usually most options income traders, they have kind of a neutral view of the market. And so they want the market to stay within a range. We're kind of a little different in that regard. But the big market moves actually can work in our favor. So we prefer that kind of environment where the market's moving.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating, John. How can people get more information and find out more about what you teach?
Sure. I have a website. It's called consistentoptionsincome.com. And they can go there, and there's a contact form. They can send me an email if they have any questions. And there's also some free videos there. They can click a button and watch the first 5 videos in my course.
All right, great. That sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay, great, Linda. Thanks for having me in. Thanks for doing all the great work.
And now we are back with our guests. We have Joe Salcihi from Stacking Benjamins. How are you, Joe?
What's happening, Linda?
Hey, happy birthday.
Thank you. I had an option to be here and I took it.
Oh, good. Excellent. And we have Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds.
Heyo.
How you doing?
Hey, it's finally warming up here. It's totally like above 30, so we may even see 40 by the end of the week. It's very exciting.
Good news. And Doug Goldstein, all the way from Israel, with Rich as a King. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Linda. I was on a glass bottom boat this week in a lot. I saw all these fish. Very cool.
Wow.
Fish in a lake. Who knew?
And sharks, too.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have everyone here. We have an interesting conversation and topic today. We had John Richardson we just listened to, and we have some interesting things to discuss because options aren't something that we really run across on a daily basis much anymore. But I remember when I was first in the industry, it was something that was part of the investment world as much as buying individual stocks and bonds were. It was something that people routinely bought options and had option strategies. So it's kind of something that's a lost art, I think. So we're going to talk about that today on the show. And our first question is, how do you think an option strategy can enhance a portfolio, or do you think it can enhance a portfolio? And let's start with Joe.
I think an option strategy can really enhance a portfolio if you know what you're doing and you're not betting. I think, like John referred to earlier, there's two ways to use options, right? You can use it to bet, and then you can also use it the way that he talked about, which is insurance. And I love the insurance analogy because, well, as an example, there's a couple of fairly risky investments that I'm looking at, and I have a choice. I can either sink a bunch of my money into those investments, or I can just buy an insurance policy that says, okay, I think these are low, I'm not sure that they're as low as they're going to go. So I'm going to invest a lot less money to hopefully buy a much bigger piece of the pie. If I'm right, and if I'm wrong, I lose a lot less money. So so I like it that way. I like it for people that have, like John referred to, have large portfolios and want to bring in consistent income. I like that. So I think there's a lot to know with options. It's like a second language.
I agree. It's a whole nother world of investing. Yeah. Yeah. Miranda, what are your thoughts about option strategies? Yeah.
A lot of them sort of revolve around Joe's. Options are not something that I've really been into, but I've written about particularly binary options quite a lot. But once again, you have to know what you're doing. And as Joe said, when you're starting to move into the binary options area, you're kind of looking into betting a little more than you are hedging. So I think that they can be useful as a hedge. I think they can be kind of a fun way to trade if you've got some extra money and you're just kind of looking for a way to try something new, kind of use your fun money, money you don't mind losing. I think that it can be a fun way to look for growth or kind of capture some income. But for me personally, it requires a lot of work. It requires a lot of thought. And that's just not my game.
Right. The passive investing is more your game, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Doug, how about you?
Well, definitely, I think you do have to be active if you're involved in options trading. When I was a rookie on Wall Street and I just got started, I was actually partners with my mother. And I was pretty good at math, so I said, hey, let me try and do some options trading. And the first week, I made a couple of $1,000, and I thought I was so smart. And of course, the next week, I gave it all back and thousands of dollars more, and I was really crushed. And my mother, because her desk was right next to mine, looked over and laughed at me. My mother's usually pretty supportive. I said, Mom, what are you laughing at? She said, it's a good thing that you lost money now when you don't have a lot. Because when you do, once you build up some wealth, then when you start trading options, you'll have a lot more to lose. And that was my introduction to options trading, that even though I did understand what was going on, and I think I was pretty good at the math, and in 20 plus years on Wall Street, I have dealt with it. I have not met people who consistently do well in the options market as a long-term strategy.
Are you talking more about puts and calls?
I am talking about only puts and calls and strategies which use them, which could be layering them and going long and short and all sorts of fancy stuff that people do.
Yeah, okay. I think that's, you know, a lot of people's exposure is puts and calls, which are basically bets for our listeners who might not be familiar, bets on a direction of a stock and which way it's going to go. And really what John's talking about are more hedged strategies for income, which does diminish risk and is really interesting. My mother was 97, passed away just 6 months ago, and she had a boyfriend who was 95. And the interesting thing about John is he was very well-to-do, and he did option strategies, and he was making consistent income with his option strategies. For a 95-year-old, I think that's a really interesting thing, but that became his hobby. And I think that was along the lines of John Richardson's approach, is some limited risk and some hedge strategies that can provide income.
What is he doing specifically there, Linda? Is he just buying covered calls or selling covered calls?
You know, I didn't really get into a deep conversation with him about it, and he passed away as well. So I just know that he really enjoyed it, and he felt that it was a lower risk way to participate, and he just loved the income generation that it provided for him. So yeah, pretty interesting. It's a whole nother world, I think, you know, from really the whole stock and bond and all the things that we normally are sort of delving into. It really is, I think, a lost art.
Yeah. And I think, too, though, that you need to have a certain temperament for it as well. You were talking about how he thought it was fun and it was kind of a fun way and it kind of became his hobby. And so I just think, too, if you're going to get into the options trading, you need to have a certain temperament and be ready for it.
I agree with that. Yeah.
I think that's funny you say that, Miranda, because I'm thinking of a cartoon that I saw a number of years ago that I think one of my clients brought into me. And it might have been, the cartoon might have been For Better or Worse, but the woman has a friend of hers over and they're standing in the door of the husband's office. And she said, yeah, I thought he retired. Turns out he just changed jobs. And the guy's sitting in front of a computer playing the stock market all day, which I think to all of our points, if you're going to get involved with options, it's that type of job.
Yeah. Well, John had some interesting things to say about the investment industry. Why do you think investors usually lose money? Miranda, what do you think about that when he commented about that? Not necessarily investing in options, but just investors in general.
Just in general. Yeah, so I think it kind of depends on I guess, where you're at with it. So part of it, if you're talking about managed investments, I think part of it has to do with the fees. Part of it has to do with putting all your faith in somebody else who can be just as wrong as anyone else. But another big part of it for most ordinary investors, and this is probably not, you know, really something that goes with anything we talked about earlier, but one of the biggest problems I think for most ordinary investors is the whole panic thing, where you see the market go down and you panic and you sell low rather than waiting. You know, a couple of weeks ago, as of the time we're recording this, a couple of weeks ago, you know, the stock market just kept, there was one day where it was just dropping and dropping and dropping. And I spent all day just watching it in fascination and wondering if it was going to drop far enough for me to want to buy extra shares of my index fund. And so I was just waiting, and I did. I spent all day just watching. It was just wonderful to watch it. And then watching my, you know, some of the people I know, oh my gosh, is this time to sell? Is it time to sell? When do I sell? And I'm just like, well, if you're at index funds, you don't. You just wait it out. And so I think it's just kind of part of the reason people lose money is they freak out. And think of all of the people who are like, oh, well, I lost all this money from my 401k in 2010. And it's like, well, yeah, you did, because that's the time that you sold everything low and moved it into bonds.
Yeah, the panic usually happens right at the wrong time.
So that's why you lost all your money. If you kept it all where it was, you'd be sitting really pretty right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that's a lot of it is that panic.
Yes. Doug, why do you think investors usually lose money?
Well, if you want to escalate the problem of that panic, you buy options. Because when you own options, first off, they're leveraged, which means it's like driving down the highway with your foot on the gas all the way and the brakes don't even work. So everything is moving much, much faster and time is against you. Most people buy options, and the moment you buy it, it has a time when it expires at zero. So it's not only that you need to be right, but you need to be right within the right time. And you can't say, well, you can't sit and watch the market and say, great, it's going down, it's going down. I'll just wait to buy in and then I'll hold on, you know, for 5 years or 10 years. If you don't get it right within the 1 month or 3 months or 1 year that you're trading, you're wiped out. So I think the answer, sorry, I just want to clarify. I think the answer is that people who don't have the personality for that kind of trading and to be on top of it are much better off in an indexed approach like we're saying here.
Well, I agree, Doug. I think there's two ways to do options. I think the first way is to be the gambler, right? Which is the way that you're talking about, where we're gambling that X is going to happen before Y date. And as you said, that's a ticking time bomb. But there's also the other half that I remember, it was a number of years ago, Phil Town used this analogy. He said, one guy's the gambler and the other person is the banker. And the banker doesn't make a lot of money on the deal, just the banker makes money on every single deal. So there's this whole other side of using options, which mm-hmm. is still, in my opinion, a full-time job, but it's much, much, much less risky. And on the side of the banker, the time's in your favor, right? The time's against the gambler, but there's two sides to every trade. So the banker side. I think people actually lose money for behavioral reasons. I think we rely on the products that we buy to do this nebulous thing called beat the market. And what John said is totally true. Most of these products have so much money in them that their goal is to come close to the market so that the manager doesn't get fired, right? Or it is an index where it's going to underperform the market by whatever the fee is. But if you look at studies in the past, that's not why people lose. People lose because they get out at the wrong time, they get in at the wrong time, and they focus on everybody else instead of focusing on their own end goal. And I think when we reframe the argument of what we're trying to do in the market, we're not trying to beat the market. We're trying to get the things that we want. And when we focus on that, I think we win more often.
And that's something that people are always asking me, well, what if you don't beat the market? And I say, I don't care if I beat the market. I don't need to beat the market. I'm indexing. And all I need to do is mirror the market minus whatever fees I'm paying. And that's enough, because what you said, my goal is not, hey, I got to beat this other person. I got to feel good about myself because I beat the market and that makes me a genius. I don't care.
Yeah.
What I care about is my future financial security, and can I do the things I want? And I don't care about anybody else.
And when he talks about delegating, earlier. I totally agree with that. I saw too many people, they don't delegate, they abdicate, right? They want to hand their money to somebody and they want to walk away and they want to come back and not pay attention to their money and have everything just be phenomenal, have it be roses. That's never going to happen. I mean, you have to be in touch with your money and hire people. As an example, somebody like Doug, who takes care of the day-to-day things, guides me to make sure that I'm making the right decisions and that I'm not making too many decisions, because that's what the average investor does. They make far too many decisions. And often a great advisor is going to tell you that the best thing to do is nothing. That's what I want to do. But I'm not hiring somebody, I'm not hiring a CFP to take my money and just do something magical with it. I'm hiring them to teach me and to guide me so that I can make better decisions on my own in the future.
Well, the thing that I love, though, see, Joe, you have a professional financial background, but you still meet with a financial planner.
Right. Oh, absolutely. You know why? Because my wife has heard my baloney over and over and over. And so for the two of us, it's far better to have a third party in the room twice a year who's saying, okay, where are we at now? Are we ahead? Are we behind on our goals? And how should we move? And the fact that I know what I'm doing, but we've got this third party who is not emotionally invested in our goals, helping us toward the future, far better.
Absolutely. And a third party can also bring in, you know, new and different ideas, perspectives, research, strategies. I mean, they can actually bring a lot to the table as well, even for experts.
Right.
You know, I think the one thing that John Richardson said was he talked about his strategy was kind of moving and adjusting with the market. So he's not just taking one trade and then hoping that that is how it turns out. He's constantly moving and adjusting. And I think that is one of the things that makes his strategy unique and probably why he's very successful at it. But also, I think he's right with investors losing money usually. And I think that is an emotional situation. They get so caught up in the headlines of, you know, Apple's doing well, or Apple's now the largest company or something. And so they go out and they buy Apple right when it's peaking. And, you know, it's interesting to me to see how often this happens, that people are buying right at the top. But also with the panic, not only are they being afraid and selling and throwing in the towel at the wrong time, but they're also listening to a lot of the media headlines and CNBC. And it seems like right at the peak and right at the trough, there's always just this emotional rush that happens with the media, and people get caught up in that and start listening to it. And so I think it is their emotion that catches up with them just at exactly the wrong time.
You know, it's funny, Linda, I just wanted to give proof exactly what she said. I spoke to a client just recently, and the market was looking awful. And she said to me, she said, Doug, watch. And I always love when people kind of figure out technically what, you know, I can see the gear is spinning. She said, why don't you watch the market? And if it goes up one day and then the next day and then a third day in a row, then let's buy.
And I said, no.
She's really calculating. And I said, well, what do you think? You want to buy when it's really up, or should we buy when it looks awful now? So we're buying it on sale. And there's like this long silence on the phone. And she goes, oh, yeah, let's do that.
Well, that's the thing that's funny. I mean, not to get too technical, but there's this whole, you know, and we've had people on that are trend followers, or not trend followers, momentum investors, excuse me.
I was going to say, Linda's the trend follower.
Yeah, yeah. But we've had momentum people on before that believe exactly what that woman said. And there's studies that show that if it goes up 3 days in a row, something that goes up is more likely to keep going up. But it's better. But to your point, Doug, it's better not to play that game. Like, why do I want to get involved with this game where I force myself to predict where the market's going to go tomorrow? Is it going to continue going up because historically that's what happens, or is it not going to because, you know, the market finds a way to disappoint the largest number of people on any given day? Man, that's a game I don't want to play.
I was just going to go back to the whole media thing, is because it gets exciting and they do want to play in those emotions because it helps them make money. It helps their stock go up.
Right.
That's right. And you definitely don't want to get into trying to time the markets. It's just a matter of if they're are some big moves that, you know, are something like 2007 and 8. If there's something like that in the future, I think that it's a good idea to be watching for that. But otherwise, trying to catch all these small moves and 3 days here and 2 days there, it's that doesn't serve anybody. Our next question, has the investment industrial complex failed the average investor? I thought it was super interesting that John his whole story about going in, thinking he's going to meet with a gray-haired investment advisor, and it was a young kid that had a presentation. I think Wall Street has certainly done a lot of that. You can't generalize, of course, every firm's different, but I thought that was a really interesting observation. And what do you think about that, Doug?
I think if we look at the bigger picture and realize that without the whole Wall Street infrastructure, people wouldn't get loans, they wouldn't be able to buy a house, they wouldn't be able to buy a car, they wouldn't have a place to invest, and they would not have access to grow their wealth over the long term. So although I'm against things like Wall Street lobbyists paying off politicians to get laws that they want, I think that we can't just go lock, stock, and barrel against the Wall Street monolith, because without it, we would be literally doomed. We would be back 500 years. Obviously, there are places for improvement, but look at all the people who've made their savings become a retirement by investing in quality companies for the long term. That is all because of people like you and me.
Mm-hmm. Miranda, what do you think?
I think Doug is absolutely crazy being all reasoned about things. What is this? You know, this sort of middle ground approach that says, hey, we need this, but we don't have to let them do everything. What is this crazy reason he's using?
Let's erase that.
I agree completely with Doug. I think that there's a lot of good here. And I think that the rise of technology and the further democratization of investing has been a great thing for many ordinary people because it's allowed us to get into indexing. I mean, the advent of the index fund, the advent of discount brokers that allow you to just take this passive approach and index is a great thing. But at the same time, we do need to, and the whole, you know, the Wall Street situation, they have helped. It has helped. It's helped more of us move forward. We have a better quality of life overall here in the United States specifically because of the way things work. But at the same time, as Doug points out, we can't just let them do whatever they want. We have to have some sort of balance. So I think that there's something there. And then I think one of the big pieces missing from just our financial system as a whole is greater education and greater just integrating it into, you know, that knowledge into our lives over the course of our lives. I mean, yeah, they say, oh, well, like one financial literacy course isn't going to change anybody's life. No, but we do a very bad job of incorporating these financial principles and knowledge into our lives at every stage. So I think part of that needs to be done as well.
That's why every school should be required to listen to the Money Tree podcast.
I'm straight.
I think, Miranda, that is an excellent point. You know, education is just so lacking, and there's a lot of great things that Wall Street can do. There's a lot of places where Wall Street could probably improve, and education is, I think, would serve everyone very well. Joe, what do you think about the investment industrial complex?
Well, I think that the big lie that a lot of traditional Wall Street has sold is that your broker is your friend and that your broker is there to make you money. And I think that the exciting part of that, to turn a negative into a positive, is the rise of the registered investment advisor instead of the broker, right? And the fiduciary standard, that all kind of comes from this people realizing that that whole thing is a lie. So financial advisors aren't bad, but I think the fact that somebody who's going to sell you stocks that fit in this traditional machine is somehow going to make you really wealthy is kind of similar to buying a lottery ticket.
Yeah, I think it was Warren Buffett who said, Wall Street is the only place where people who take the subway to work advise people who ride in limousines.
Right. Right. You know, I saw there was a discount brokerage commercial. This is a few years ago. You guys might remember this, where there's a young broker sitting across a really expensive desk from a guy who's nearing retirement. And the broker leans forward and says, I see an expensive sports car. And the guy nearing retirement goes, yeah. And he said, well, maybe a yacht. The guy goes, yeah. He goes, how about a villa in Tuscany by 47? And the old guy looks and goes, I'm 58. And the broker goes, oh, we were talking about you?
Oh, yeah.
Ouch.
There's definitely some of that. I think just the whole image of Wall Street can be revamped and revisited.
I think that one of the best ways for people to find an advisor, and I tell this to people all the time when they say, hey, Doug, you know, will you manage my money? And we talk for a long time, and then I'll say, you know, you should shop around, because the most important thing in finding an advisor is not the guy who's going to tell you that he knows how to make you the most money. Because when someone says that, it's time to run away. It's try to find the person who's going to sit and listen to your situation and really, really understand who you are before starting with recommendations, because that way the recommendations make sense for who you are and not based on whether the person in fact is a biblical prophet who can tell the future.
And just to jump on what Doug's saying, because I love that, the second step then is, as we all well know, the somebody can sit across the desk from you and tell you a lot of stuff that sounds awesome. Go to the FINRA website and go to Broker Check, and that will also show you that if there have been any discrepancies, any problems with the person in the past, you can look up all those and then ask the person about any of those problems that past clients might have had.
Excellent advice, Joe. Well, thank you once again. That was excellent. John Richardson has some free gifts for you, a video training at consistentoptionsincome.com/moneytreeinvesting. He did that just for our podcast. So go to consistentoptionsincome.com/moneytreeinvesting. Learn more about what John is doing and his interesting strategies. That's another wrap. We will see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.